Hey, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process and their job. Changing it up a little bit this week, this is a bonus podcast, and we're bringing on Lauren Duca, who is a weekend editor of Teen Vogue, as well as a freelance journalist. If that name is not familiar, the piece she wrote might be. Her piece, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, that ran on Teen Vogue, captured a lot of attention, more than a million page views at this point, got Teen Vogue to trend on Twitter, as well as I think people recognizing and realizing that that publication has done a lot of political commentary. And it is Lauren Duca's thesis that Donald Trump's rise to power has awakened a force of bigotry by condoning and encouraging hatred, but also by normalizing deception, gaslight being manipulating a person or people to the point where they question their own sanity. That is Lauren Duca's think piece on the subject, and it was read by a lot of people. As part of this podcast, I asked Lauren when she realized that this piece had cut through all the clutter of other think pieces and really blown up on social media.
I guess when, like, Dan Rather shared it on Facebook was kind of when I was like, oh, okay, this is really happening right now. This is not just, like, I'm getting a lot of buzz.
Our conversation also gets into what is it like to be a young journalist and to have a piece blow up and to get invitations to come on places like CNN and Al Jazeera and Chelsea Handler. We'll talk about why she opted to do this piece for Teen Vogue and some other stuff as well. So Lauren Duca is the Sports Illustrated Media podcast guest. We've got a little special edition here. Let's go to Lauren Duca in New York City. Okay, and as we said at the top, here is Lauren Duca, the writer who wrote the Teen Vogue piece. She's a weekend editor of Teen Vogue, also a freelance journalist. Lauren, we usually stick to sports media people, but we're making an exception for you. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm really sorry that I don't know anything about sports.
All right, trust me, we're not going to ask you to name an offensive lineman on the Chargers or who leads the NHL in scoring.
Tom Brady, I don't know, but okay, thank you.
not really close, Lauren, but we appreciate you giving it your best shot, though. In your piece, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, you argue that Donald Trump's rise to power has awakened, this is your words, a force of bigotry by condoning and encouraging hatred, but also by normalizing deception, gaslighting, basically, to make the layman's best possible layman's terms, basically when a person is manipulating a point so that the other person or groups of people start questioning their own sanity about their point, and you argue that Trump has done that. So for anyone listening, obviously Lauren has a point of view on Donald Trump. We're not going to pretend that she doesn't, and that's where this piece comes from. Lauren, the reason I wanted to have you on, of course, is that there have been many think pieces about Donald Trump, about Hillary Clinton, about politics. This piece, for whatever reason, cut through all that and crossed over into a larger news/popular culture. I will ask you about how many views the piece has gotten at this point. The piece got Teen Vogue to trend on Twitter. So it really affected people. So let's start from the beginning. I want to know when and where you wrote this piece.
So I had been thinking about this a lot. I had been thinking about the term gaslighting. I actually kind of had this discussion on my own podcast, which is the real thing and not a plug. But I have a podcast called Strangers from Twitter, and we sort of had an election postmortem and latched onto that term. So this is something I had kind of been working through on my own, and I hadn't really found a home for it. And I'm a weekend editor at Teen Vogue, so I was on when I saw his response to the CIA assessment, and I just, you know, felt my blood boiling yet again. And I thought, you know, we can just straight write this up and have kind of, you know, facts. This wasn't the biggest electoral college victory, and, you know, this is insane that we're challenging the intelligence industry of the United States right now. And it just felt so right to attach the idea to that specific peg. And I think that part of the reason why it took off, I mean, there's a lot of factors. The fact that it came from Teen Vogue, and I'm sure we'll get into that in a little bit, so I won't go on and on about that. But also, I think that, you know, there's been pieces that about his Trump's deception and about Trump's lying, and sometimes there are individual kind of one-off reflections on how he's lying about a specific instance or how he's lying overall. But I think that the actual term gaslighting and the form of abuse and the sinister way it is manipulating people into kind of losing touch with a foundation from which to defend themselves is what was so moving, because it's one thing to say he lies and politicians lie, but the effect that it's really had on our personal conversations and then a grander media conversation is just astounding. So I think that that visceral example of the way the term, you know, where the term comes from and the way it unfolds in the play, like, really resonated with people who are feeling frustrated and can't quite put their finger on why, beyond being terrified and the fact that he's lying all the time.
So let's get back to the process of it. Where did you write it? How long did it take to write?
So I had a kind of shell of it that was sort of just the intro was Donald Trump lies. Here are some examples, kind of sitting on my computer. And I kind of just wrote it for myself, that, and I didn't know if I was going to find a home for it. But so the adapting it to fit Teen Vogue probably took like two hours. I ran it through with my editorial director, the editorial director of Teen Vogue, Phil Picardi, who is incredible and a huge part of everything Teen Vogue has been doing online. Elaine Weltroth is in charge of the print side of things, and she absolutely deserves credit and has shown what kind of amazing things happen, I think, when a woman of color is in that kind of position of power. But also Phil's name probably hasn't gotten floated out there enough. And he was there. He knew this would be, you know, we would get some backlash. He knew it was kind of a radical thing to do. So he was there kind of running a fine-tooth comb over everything I had in the piece, because it would have been a pretty huge misstep to have a mistake in a piece about the importance of facts and information.
Right. Interesting. So, all right. So in that sense, then, that you, because my question was going to be, did you write it for Teen Vogue, or did you pitch it? I'm sorry. Did you write it and pitch it around? So it's very clear at a certain point you decided this piece was going to be a Teen Vogue piece.
Right. Yes. It didn't come to fruition from that initially, but I was on and I was working and I, you know, kind of had access to the CMS, and I was like, why am I sitting on this? This is another moment where this particular strategy of his is highlighted, unfortunately, yet again. So it just seemed like it made sense.
Did your editors immediately tell you that they wanted this, that they were going to run it?
Yes. So I sort of run the site on the weekend. It's funny because so many people now are responding to me and saying, you know, they should hire you full time. And I mean, I'm very close with Phil. I think that that would be a conversation if I wanted to have it. It's funny. He actually responded to someone on Twitter and was like, I actually don't think she would sign anything right now. And it's like, that's not, you know, that's, I kind of run the site on the weekend. It's a lot of responsibility. I have, you know, the news judgment overall, and, you know, I work closely with Phil, but I'm, you know, that they have a really important kind of hot brand right now. And I really enjoy doing that. It's something different than during the week when I usually work on reported features and longer work. So while I'm actually doing the kind of quicker aggregated stuff, it requires a kind of higher level of experience, I think, I think that's why they hired me, because they could, you know, they probably could have found someone out of school who just like is quick and quippy if they just wanted the things executed, but I was kind of like overviewing the site. So that's like an ongoing discussion in terms of their visibility right now and their brand. I mean, I'm an independent contractor, so I'm less behind that than I'm helping to execute it, but I guess that's kind of how things work on the weekend.
So here's something that's really interesting to me. I looked at the timestamp on the piece. It's December 10th. That's a Saturday. And the timestamp is 11:40 a.m. Is that when the piece went out, Saturday at 11:40 a.m.?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, so that's hilarious just to me in the fact that I can't think of a less traffic time than to drop a piece Saturday morning, 11:40 Eastern time. So that's interesting in itself. So now the piece goes, and if you could, take the listeners through what is happening in the first hour or two or three. When I became aware of this, might have actually been the next day, honestly. So that's Sunday. Mm-hmm. So I honestly have no idea what the initial hours were like. Did you notice that the piece was being shared or seen quickly, or was it basically doing whatever a normal Teen Vogue post would do on Saturday until something happened?
I don't know exactly when it really started taking off. It's funny because, so I'm like a crazy obsessive Twitter user. I could talk to you about Twitter for hours, which is, I know people think it's, a lot of people think it's really frivolous, but it's kind of my bread and butter. I've gotten a lot of work from Twitter, especially as a freelancer. So I mean, I know I'm obsessed with it and I'm on it too much, but it's also connected to my livelihood. But anyway, I am on Twitter all the time. And so I was watching it and I was aware that it was getting more engagement than I would have expected, both for a Teen Vogue piece or for something kind of fiery and controversial that I might have tweeted about Trump. My presence is super political, so I've had a lot of things take off and go kind of like small-time viral or just, you know, get a lot of buzz on Twitter. And so it's weird because I had thought I had things go viral before, and now I realize that's not the case, or that maybe we need like a new word for the kind of viral this went, like for something to go true. I've never seen anything like this. I think it's, I guess when like Dan Rather shared it on Facebook was kind of when I was like, oh, okay, this is really happening right now. This is not just like I'm getting a lot of buzz. I don't know. And that's just based on my assumption that like Dan Rather as a living legend is like too busy to be like on Twitter on a Saturday like I am. So that made me realize it was kind of catching more of a wave than just within my personal following or Teen Vogue following.
That's interesting. So there was nobody, because I would have thought that maybe somebody really famous retweeted it and that got it to an attention. I did see Rather posted it on Facebook, but you know, I don't know if that was the match that lit stuff. So this is very, it seems like very organic, right? It found people, they shared it both on Facebook, Twitter, wherever else, and it was almost an organic growth rather than a couple of very heavy social media users who put it out there into the ecosystem.
Yeah, well, you know, I think about things going viral. A month or two ago, I profiled Chewbacca Mom for Cosmo. So I was thinking about the way things go viral. And, you know, I don't think that you could sit and you could have like BuzzFeed and like Tyler Oakley and the New York Times. And like, you know, you could hit a bunch of different demographics and they could all be in a summit and be like, we want to try and really push X feature. I don't even think you could make something go viral that way. You could give it a huge social lift and you could, you know, give it a lot of promotion, but it almost has to have this organic power to spread that way. You just need like that fabric of excitement for it to really take something to really take off. And it's just, that's interesting because I feel like the viral has to be organic, I guess, is my point.
At what point did you, and maybe it was the Rather point, but at what point did you realize that, man, like I've now written a piece that is going to traffic in more than a million page views and is going to be a piece that people, like for lack of a better phrase, in the political class will be writing about, as we saw on Slate and as we saw in many other, you know, your piece launched its own sort of group of think pieces, most of them focusing around Teen Vogue, and Teen Vogue, maybe people didn't realize, has done a lot of really good political coverage. But was there a point on Saturday or Sunday when you or your editors were like, all right, this, you know, the chart beat on this is going through the roof here?
I guess that we were back and forth. Phil and I were just kind of, you know, sharing, oh my God, text messages. But, you know, I think when I was like, I went on CNN on Monday. So I guess when I got that request,
Okay.
I was sort of, that was, oh, holy shit, CNN. Okay. I don't know. I think it's interesting that I mean, the team that it was from Teen Vogue is a huge part of it, but it's, there's something really simple about it. Like, it's really not that revolutionary of an idea at all. It's just, I think that people like to be reminded that they can be empowered by facts. Like, there's something comforting about being able to be like, oh shit, our boyfriend is abusive, and it's like, it's our boyfriend here is Donald Trump, I guess. Like, it's just sort of like this, like, we're being, this is what we're dealing with, this is why it feels this way, this is why we're like having little frenzies over, is Hamilton a distraction, is this a distraction? It all feels like a distraction because it's hard to put your finger on what's actually happening. So I feel like part of the excitement over it was this insistence on fact-checking and, you know, the importance of not being distracted by fake news, or like how to kind of navigate like a mistrust in media. It hit on like a core connecting idea between all of those things that sort of maybe made people realize that they have an individual culpability, responsibility, whatever, to inform themselves and to not just accept whatever is fed to them.
How many page views at this point, do you know?
It was over a million last time I checked.
Wow.
But that was like 2 days ago, yeah.
I think, to me, one of the things, and you know, we can sort of get into this now, as you sort of mentioned near the top, I think people were surprised at Teen Vogue was the place that this ran, and it is not something they would normally connect to, you know, whatever, the National Review, Real Clear Politics, The Nation, et cetera. So I think that was, it seemed to me that that was part of it, the sort of unexpectedness of this. And I also wonder if maybe your age factored into this as well. You're in your 20s, I'm assuming. Is that right? Okay.
I'm 25, yeah.
25, okay. So young writer, one, relatively young writer, and then two, Teen Vogue. As you've sort of processed all this, how much do you think the fact that it was published on Teen Vogue was part of the reason that maybe people found it or found it really particularly interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is obviously a factor, and I think that it's there's definitely some condescension in the surprise. It's only because they've been doing this for one, but there's also some sort of, I don't know, just like shock at the need for it, kind of, which is super frustrating. I think that a lot of times teen girls are kind of positioned as other, and like in the sense that it's, oh, teen girls care about makeup and shoes and have an interest in Kylie Jenner's Instagram account. It's, they can also have an investment in political discussions and the future of this country. It's just sort of very strange that we think of that as though it should be separate. And I think that's true for women's media overall, and then especially true for, you know, Teen Vogue or 17, or, you know, and certainly other sites have done this before. I think Rookie is a really good example. You know, Tavi has been woke for years, and Teen Vogue has been doing really well lately. I think, especially in this fraught political moment, that a lot of brands have been waking up and producing more ethically driven content, and that it's an awareness of informing, you know, a group of voters that is now, you know, millennials, I guess, so, you know, the teen cutoff, there's some younger readers that are not quite in the millennial bracket, but millennials are 31% of the electorate now. You know, they're rivaling baby boomers in terms of their influence. You know, they have the potential, but we have the potential to influence elections for the next 35 years. Like, this is significant. This is not, you know, millennials are often written off. Teen girls are written off. Women are written off. It's just, it's very interesting who we empower with political discourse and information. And so I think that this is a natural fit, and I'm hoping that it's going to be like the first of many things we see like this.
And you mentioned about Teen Vogue, and I'm glad you did, because I think there probably was some condescension. There was a good piece on Slate that I referenced before that looks at Teen Vogue's political coverage and why your piece, by the way, should not be a surprise. And it sort of has fit into what they've done editorially, and good on them. The other facet, Lauren, that I want to get into, which is very interesting to me, is, okay, you're 25 and you obviously had some pieces published in some name brands, and mm-hmm. you know, you're a freelancer who's sort of at the early stages of your career and making contacts and obviously getting published at different places. But this is very different. I mean, this is, you know, there are people who are far older and experienced than you who will not publish a piece that gets close to a million page views. So how has this piece in the short term intrinsically, if it has, changed what's going on with you professionally day to day?
A lot. So yeah, it's incredible actually how I think a lot about freelancing actually in general has totally changed my profile. I was at HuffPost actually, I just hit a year. I left HuffPost on November 8th, actually, dark day, but on 2015. And so it's been a year now, and I had like 4,000 followers on Twitter, and I had no other bylines outside of HuffPost. So I've really been working to build myself up over the past year, and it's like, it's incredible how a year of work and bylines in Vice and the New Yorker and the Nation and Pacific Standard and a lot of other names that I'm very proud to have participated in, you know, that took me to like 23,000 followers just to give number to it. And now I'm almost at 40,000 since the piece was published on Saturday. So just in terms of personal direct reach on Twitter, you know, it's almost doubled from publishing one single piece. So, and then also I am working on a book proposal, which I actually was already working on, which is very lucky. But now I have like 50 agents in my inbox, and I actually hooked up with an agent last week. So I was actually really glad to have that have happened because she's sort of there for me through the insanity, and it's not winnowing through all of that. But I mean, CNN, and I went and did Chelsea Handler's show, and Chelsea Handler apparently like wants me to come back on season two. Like, so who knows? Like, which there are a couple things, possible things that could happen now, and it's like even if one half of them ends up panning out, this will have been an unimaginable boost that I couldn't have even worked towards. I don't think it was sort of like if you're playing like a video game and you've got like a little speed burst, like it feels like that is what happened, but for my career.
Had before the CNN hit, before Chelsea Handler, was there any other television entity that you were invited to this past week?
Yeah, I'm doing Dan Rather's radio show on Tuesday, and last night I was on Al Jazeera English, although that was, I have to watch that. That was, they asked me what gaslighting is, and then they asked me about Hillary's conflict of interest, so I don't even know if they, I don't understand if I was just like supposed to be a commenting as their like American weigh in on their topic based on the Teen Vogue piece, which is, I have to watch the clip actually, because I thought that was kind of interesting that it went from like discuss the piece and it going viral and, you know, the state of political commentary and teen magazines to just sort of weigh in on this political topic overall. So I don't know. I have to actually watch that, though, to be honest.
I was going to get to the idea of, was this the first time for you that you had appeared on national television? And as someone who's young, 25, was that, what was that process like for you? Was that nerve-wracking to be part of big media as opposed to, you know, someone who's mostly writing for online entities?
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, the piece taking off has resulted in this, but I think especially CNN has went to some really ugly messages. Like, I've been threatened with doxing, and I don't even know how seriously to take that, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, as a woman online, like TM, like I get, you know, death and rape threats if I have anything kind of take off at all, like, you know, even hit kind of a couple thousand level of viewership. So I knew that was going to be part of this, unfortunately. But CNN especially resulted in a lot of anger, and it at a way wider scale than I could have anticipated. In terms of actually being on TV, it was certainly, once I was there and talking, I mean, I was clearly nervous, even on Chelsea. I was definitely not her smoothest guest, but she had J-Law on, like, you know, the next day. I don't know, I had a lot of competition, but I think once I was doing it, I felt comfortable. Like, once, it's funny because, you know, you sit all day and you're like, I'm going to be on this show later, and you just are like trying to remember if you're going to know how to speak. And then once you're in the moment, it's, you know about this. You're the expert on the thing you wrote, of course. Like, it's just, the conversations I've been having with friends, but on a more formal, performative level, obviously.
Chelsea, you and Jennifer Lawrence, it's like she's looking obviously for, she wanted well-known 26-year-old and under, so congrats.
Yeah.
The last part I want to get into is, you mentioned that Twitter is sort of a place, and understandably, where you live, and a lot of your professional interaction happens there. You obviously, from many quarters, received an incredible amount of praise and thanks for writing the piece. But I do wonder what kind of backlash you received. And, you know, that's the one thing that's always interesting. I don't really want to get into myself here, but because it's, I would get it minor compared to anybody well known. But anytime you enter any kind of political thought, debate, and you have any kind of healthy number of Twitter followers, there's always going to be a group of people who are not going to be happy with what your politics are, or even, at least in sports, the fact that you're talking politics. So for your case, while there's no doubt that I would imagine most of the online feedback was more positive than negative, did you face any kind of negative backlash? If so, what was that like? And it was probably more negative backlash than you've ever faced just because of the sheer number of people who read this piece.
I will say, and I have to be a little positive. And honestly, it's what I hate about myself, I guess it sounds weird to finish the sentence that way, is, but, you know, every hateful thing I feel like takes such a toll on me, where it's sort of the weighting of it is totally uneven, and one awful, nasty message compared to 20 amazing, beautiful, inspiring ones is just, that's about how they measure up in terms of how they affect me. And so that sucks. But the ratio has been predominantly in favor of the positive. I mean, the sweetest messages, it's cool because, like, there really were cool, big personalities tweeting this. Like, I got an email from Maria Shriver. Wow. I got, you know, Sarah Silverman tweeted it. Patton Oswalt, obviously Chelsea Handler, like, read it herself, and she's always been one of my heroes. Jessica Valenti, like, some of these people are people, you know, Maria Shriver, Chelsea Handler, and Jessica Valenti are three of my first heroes. Like, this was just unbelievable that they even thought about me for a second. It was just incredible. So overwhelmingly positive. But yeah, it's, to have anything at this volume, honestly, like, if I had something at this volume and it was about, like, I don't know, if it was the Chewbacca mom profile that took off like this, or, you know, not that it would, but if I was writing about Hamilton or something non, you know, positive and silly and pop culture, whatever related, and it took off like this, there would be hate. So especially because it's political and it's divisive, there was a lot of anger. So what frustrates me about that is I really try to take a position here where I was talking about, you know, and I actually think I could have maybe been more explicit about this in the piece, but I've kind of only really fully developed this thought talking about it so much this week. But I really feel that Trump supporters are a victim of Trump's gaslighting too. And part of what the point I was trying to make is that, you know, holding the president accountable should be in everyone's best interest. I think that that's kind of what we've seen with Joe Walsh coming forward, who is, you know, a really strong fringe voice on the right, being like, you know, wake up, this isn't right. The president should want to know if Russia interfered in our election. So to hear, I think that makes perfect sense that his voice will be even stronger than anything like this from a liberal woman could ever be. But it's just sort of, if you're reacting to this with anger, what are you actually angry at? Because, you know, I could have written, and I very specifically tried to be as nonpartisan as possible. So when I went through and picked facts, I was trying to pick really clear-cut things that were sort of, he said X, the truth is Y. But, you know, for example, I avoided the pussy grabbing incident because that's apparently become a little more controversial, and you even have some kind of people in the middle of the line ideologically, like, defending Trump and saying he wasn't admitting to sexual assault and it's just sort of, you know, he was just talking or, you know, whatever. And we don't need to get into that by any means, and, like, actually, let's please not. But I specifically avoided that because I knew that, you know, caused people to fall in different lines of things. This was sort of like, here is a concrete fact that he is contradicting in some way. And so thought that that was very interesting, that even saying, hey, here's concrete and you know, evidence that that the candidate is lying made people so angry. It just sort of shows the drama of American public politics and the sort of like intense anger that's associated with, I think, often in a way that really isn't validated by anything besides hatred, maybe. That's a little extreme, but that's kind of been my experience of the ugliness the past couple of days.
Lauren, what are you working on right now?
this book proposal. Wish me luck.
yeah, never, as a general rule, don't go public with your book proposal idea before it's in the hands of publishers. Lauren Duca has been the guest on this bonus edition of the Sports Illustrated podcast. She is a weekend editor of Teen Vogue, also a freelance journalist. And her piece, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, as she mentioned, more than a million page views on that site. And it got a young writer in the midst of the conversation over this election, as she mentioned, got her on CNN and Chelsea Handler. And these are, generally speaking, not things that happen when you're a weekend editor writing a post. So that's very cool and exciting. I totally wish you luck with the proposal. And you're a talented writer, so I hope that you keep writing, and I imagine good things will be happening for you in the future. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks.
All right, my thanks to Lauren Duca of Teen Vogue. We wish her the best of luck with her proposal. This is obviously sort of a bonus edition, but I found her sort of I just found the idea of like what happens to somebody when they write a piece that, especially when they're young, blows up, and how that happens and how they handle that. And, you know, she's a name we'll look for in the business. Only 20, I think 5, she said. So best of luck to her. Previous podcast guests have been Barstool Sports CEO Erica Nardini. You can check that out, as well as Joe Tessitore of ESPN. You know, this podcast traditionally, of course, will have sports media voices, and that will continue with the every now and then change up, which is Lauren Duca. All right, for my producer, Lou Pellegrino, for digital media, for the Sports Illustrated Crew Sporting Podcast, Ben Eagle, John Wertheim, Chris Stone, Ryan Hunt. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.